So this morning is the fifth of our six series. And for those of you that are interested, I'm going to stay after today. So if you will take a little break and put things back together. But if you'd like to stay and talk about any of the stuff that I'm talking about today or what I've been talking about or anything that's written in a little book that some of you got, please feel free to do that because we can have a... There's a fair amount in that writing that I haven't covered, and you may have some questions about that or anything else. Okay, so feel free to stay if you'd like. So far, we've been talking about these fundamental teachings: emptiness, dependent co-arising, no self, Buddha nature, practice realization, bodhisattva path. And at this point, I'd like to talk about the spirit of our practice. So all of these teachings point to an engagement with life, with our ordinary life, as a part of reality instead of as a separate person, even though we are separate, and acting to benefit ourselves and others. So this is the basis of our Zazen practice. The teachings of emptiness and co-arising tell us... Oh, Shinshu, would you hand me my Rakusu? I forgot to put it back on again. Tell us that we and everything else are not separate, isolated beings, right? Like I said, we exist fully in our individuality. Completely, this is really important, don't forget this, we exist completely in our individuality, and we're also empty of separateness, empty of isolation. You can ask questions about things like this, too. What is this bib that people wear? So, empty of isolated existence, and that we're completely dependent upon one another for our existence. We're not self-generated. All you have to do is sit down and breathe to remember this. Right? If you put like a balloon over your head, you wouldn't last very long. So, even at the very basic way, we're dependent on one another for our existence. Our very self... basis of how we experience the world. The self is the meaning-making, the constructing activity. It's that which structures our world. We all have one, and it's good to have one, but it gets a little confused. So what we want to work on is transforming that self, right? Not obliterating it. So this is the deepest aspect of our being, this self. And it exists in conjunction with everything else. So we practice this truth every day by following the Bodhisattva way. We talked about the Bodhisattva path last week, about our vow to live and be lived for the benefit of all beings. And as we do this, we realize that enlightenment is not a state that we can grasp or possess. It is alive in each moment that we practice the Buddha way. This is what Dogen calls practice realization. So this is a little quickie summary of all we've been talking about. There is no other self other than the, or other life, that you must create to make these teachings so. Okay? There's no other self and no other life that you need to make or create or change in order to practice these things. Your life has everything you need in it. You are Buddha nature. You are the living reality of all beings. That's your fundamental truth. So it's not a matter of repackaging something, you know, constructing something new, creating something new. What is this saying? There's nothing new under the sun. Well, this very life that you have, this is not different from this vivid, enlivening truth. So, all of this, though, we say, okay, that's good, but how do I do that? One of the ways that we support our ability to practice the Buddha way is to take a look at our ordinary lives, to take a look at the way we order our lives, what we rest in, what guides us, what we value, and how does that match up with what we actually do, right? So we can say, I want to be kind, and then we turn around and crab at people all over the place, right? It's like this. I'm committed to waking up and living for the benefit of all beings, but damn it, get out of my way, right? There's a disconnect there, and it's a disconnect that we all live with to some extent. I'm in a hurry. My life is important. And it is, it's important. But we need to look at what is it that orders our lives and how does that actually play out? So this I believe is what we call faith. And that's what I'm going to talk about today is faith. So faith in Buddhism has many meanings. And it's changed and developed over the years. But there are some key things it doesn't mean. Faith does not mean blind belief, okay? It doesn't mean believing in a set of dogmas, set of ideas. And it is not in opposition to doubt, to questioning. This is super important. Intelligent and critical inquiry into the validity of the teachings is essential. You have to test these things out. Now, I'm not talking about what I call corrosive doubt. Corrosive doubt is, oh, this will never work for me. I'm like, you know, blah, 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 blah. That kind of undermining questioning. Undermining, dismissive. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about kind of upright looking at things and saying, well, let's see. What about this? That is a function of faith. That is what makes faith possible. Stephen Batchelor said, faith is the confidence to follow the path of doubt to the end. Faith is the confidence to follow the path of doubt to the end. Faith is what keeps us going where we say, what is this? What is? Well, how does this work? And we keep energizing. We keep looking at things. We keep engaging. In the Pali Suttas, faith is listed as one of the five spiritual faculties, along with vigor, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. So even though there's shifts in what faith means in different Buddhist traditions, its roots in intelligent inquiry are never lost. So no one is asking you to sign on a dotted line in order to enter the Zendo or start to practice or keep practicing. There's a teaching in the Pali Suttas called the Kalama Sutta. Have any of you heard of this before? It's really quite delightful. The story is this. There's a village that's at the crossroads. I imagine it on the Silk Road, right? Where all of these merchants and all of these teachers are coming and going through this village. It's like it's perfectly located to be on the kind of spiritual teacher route. I think maybe Santa Cruz is a little like that.
Santa Cruz and Berkeley.
Cruz and Berkeley. Like, that's what I do. Okay. So the Buddha's one of these people. The Buddha comes into town and they say, how do we know what's true? What should we believe? What, you know, how do we tell what works? And he says, he tells them this. Okay. He says, do not go upon what has been acquired by repeated hearing. In other words, just because somebody tells you the same thing over and over again, don't necessarily believe it. Do not go upon tradition. Do not go upon rumor. Do not go upon what is in the scripture, nor upon surmise, nor upon axiom, nor upon specious reasoning, nor upon a bias towards a notion that has been pondered over, nor upon another's seeming ability, nor upon the consideration, this monk is our teacher. Kalamas, when you yourselves know, these things are good, these things are not blamable, these things are praised by the wise, undertaken and observed, these things lead to benefit and happiness. Enter on and abide in them. Okay, I'm going to repeat that. Kalamas, when you yourselves know these things are good, these things are not blamable, these things are praised by the wise, undertaken and observed, these things lead to benefit and happiness. Enter on and abide by them. So, this is often quoted as a way of encouraging people to take responsibility for examining the teachings, testing them out in their own lives, and seeing, does it work? Does this produce greater peace in my life? Is the fruit of this harmony in my relationships, a greater stillness in my being? What happens? The proof is in the pudding. Now, that doesn't mean that if you undertake a process, for example, of sitting down and looking at your own mind, you might get a little agitated, you know? You might decide that you need to, like, clean the house instead. And that can be a little discouraging or a little distressing. In other words, you know, sitting down and paying attention to your own mind can upset the apple cart a little bit. Things might not be so smooth, but there's a fundamental feeling of wholesomeness about it, right? Oh, I'm noticing that actually I'm pretty selfish sometimes. I'm pretty demanding sometimes. I'm pretty agitated sometimes. I don't like that feeling. I want the peace of believing that I'm really better than everybody else. But that's not what we're talking about here, right? I think we know it's like, you can pay attention to the food that you eat, right? Is it wholesome, nutritious food, or is it Twinkies? Twinkies are not bad. It's okay to have a Twinkie. But if you live on Twinkies, that's a problem. So this testing is the foundation of faith. This trying it out.
Question?
Yeah.
It still seems there's a challenge, though, because the body is easily deceived, right? Some of our body senses might think, I like Twinkies. And our mind can fool itself.
Great. So this is the next point I was going to bring up. Because the part, the Kalama Sutra is quoted a lot, but the part that gets left off a lot is that one does this in dialogue with a trusted other, a teacher, an elder, a wise person. This doesn't have to be me or Shinshu. It can be a friend that you know is sane and good. You know, you can talk about, is this working? You have good spiritual friends are really, really important to the path. So always this is tested out with others. We examine and then we test out with others. We examine and we talk about it. So it's not a solitary project, and it's not blind faith. It's a process of proving to ourselves, making authentic what's in the teachings. So in Zen, this is often called proving or authentication, making it real. In the early suttas, it says, faith is the seed watered by practice. Faith is the seed watered by practice. Through practice, one finds that the teachings actually work. But I would also add that practice can be the seed. Faith can water it. So there's a kind of a dialogue here. So Thich Nhat Hanh says, faith is the confidence we receive when we put into practice a teaching that helps us overcome difficulty. Faith is the confidence we receive. It grows in us like a seed grows in us. It's already there. It just needs watering. The truth is there, according to the Dharma. It just needs watering. It needs to be made real so that we believe it. We test it. So again, this is not a belief in a set of ideals. It's a confidence that grows through action. Confidence is an interesting confidere. Fidere is faith, right? Con is with faith. And it's also the root fidere is fidelity. You know, being close with, being true to. So there's a sense of true, which is also related to trust. The sense of true, not in true and false, but true, like plumb, in line. So in the questions of King Milindra, which is in the Pali Canon, King Milindra asks very pointed questions, and then he says, give me an example. So he's a kind of model of this kind of development of faith. So in response to the king's question, what is the mark of faith? The senior monk Nagasena says, faith makes serene and leaps forward. Faith makes serene and leaps forward. And Nagasena compares faith to a miraculous water-clearing gem. This is a gem that if you put it in water, all the sediments fall out, and it becomes clear and pure. So the defilements, the delusions, settle to the bottom. It settles the mud in the bottom of the stream. And faith inspires the practitioner to leap forward, for, as Nagasena says, when the practitioner sees the hearts of others that have been set free, he leaps forward by way of aspiration. So we inspire one another, right? We look at people, you know, for example, I talked about Nelson Mandela. Great inspiration to us. Inspires us to practice nonviolence, inspires us to deal with the adversity we face in our lives, to deal with racism and oppression, to deal with these things, and to find a way to actually do it and not abandon our deepest principles, but actually live them out. This is this kind of faith, right? We see someone and we're inspired. Yes, I want to do that too. So, from this perspective of faith, obscurations fade, the way is made clear, and the practitioner is able to practice. So this is a kind of attitude that we can grow, something we can cultivate, this kind of faith. It clarifies our lives. And this is the basis of the way we understand faith, this testing, clarification, inspiration. Very important. In Soto Zen, there's an addition to this. There's another dimension to this. So, in Soto Zen, the teaching is that everything, including ourselves, is already Buddha. Already the dynamic functioning of the entire universe. Right from the beginning. what we call awakening or enlightenment is the process of making that real for ourselves. So, if you think about this glass of muddy water that the gem is put in, you know, makes sense to us. Oh, clarifies. Dogen says, the mud in the water, that's also enlightenment. We're not clarifying, we're living in what we have. This is a little tough for us to get sometimes. We want to make real this experience that awakening and enlightenment is already present in our life. Buddha's way is already alive. Dogen says, it is imperative for those practicing the way to believe in it. Those who have faith in the way should know for certain that they are unfailingly in the way from the very beginning. Believing in such a manner and penetrating the way thus, practice accordingly. You want to hear that again? Mm-hmm. It is imperative for those practicing the way to believe in it. Those who have faith in the way should know for certain that they are unfailingly in the way from the very beginning. So can you feel this kind of little shift here, or maybe major shift? They're not in opposition one another, but the first way is this proving process, this testing process, which doesn't stop. But then there's another element that comes in here, which is you're already of it. This very moment is already Buddha. What does that mean? What is it like to have faith in that? What is it like to enact that in my life? So this requires that we release our self-centered habits and open to the moment as it is. Yeah? Practice frees our full responsiveness. The individual person does not cease to appear, does not disappear, okay? Once again, important. But we, as we let go of self-centered notions and open to the reality of the moment, we notice something about who we are. We notice, oh, this is already Buddha. Do you see? We become a part of the ecology of reality. We become a part of the dynamic functioning of this moment. Not this self and that. There's a feeling about this. There's a feeling about inviting this sense into our lives. It's very distinctly a part of Soto Zen. So again, there's this testing, there's this making real. As Thich Nhat Hanh, does this help with the difficulties in my life? Am I calmer? Am I less grumpy? Does this work? This is essential. And already grumpy Buddha, right? The dynamic functioning of this site is already Buddha. What does that mean? How can that be? That's the kind of feeling that we have in Soto Zen practice. So this shift from I'm here and I'm observing there, this shift from placing ourselves in the center of reality without evaporating ourselves is this fundamental to Soto Zen practice. Shohaku Okumura says, and he's discussing a fast called Dogen's, called the Mountains and Rivers Sutra, which is beautiful. If you haven't read it, I recommend it. It's very alive with imagery and the vitality of mountains, rivers, streams, and it's also very difficult. So this is what Shohaku Okumura has to say about our practice. This, what I was talking about, this movement, this openness, this already is Buddha. Shohaku says, it is Buddha studying Buddha's way through our practice. It is Buddha studying Buddha's way through our practice. It is Dharma, the way all beings are, studying Dharma through our study. When we sit, it is not us sitting Zazen, but Zazen sitting Zazen. Our practice is Buddha's life. It is the manifestation of Buddha. Can you feel the difference between these two ways? Do you want to hear that again?
Yes.
It is Buddha studying Buddha's way through our practice. It is mountains studying mountains. It is waters studying waters, enacting mountains, enacting mountain. Waters enacting water. It is Buddha studying Buddha's way through our practice. And it is Dharma studying Dharma through our study. When we sit, it is not us sitting Zazen, but Zazen sitting Zazen. Our practice is Buddha's life. It is the manifestation of Buddha. This is deeply challenging to us, right? Just like we say, well, what does that mean? This is a koan. What does that mean? What is Buddha? How is this Buddha studying Buddha's way? I know that I'm greedy, and I know that I'm deluded, and I know that I'm not a perfect Buddha. I know those things about myself. I know I'm a self. What does this mean? How is this? How is this Buddha studying Buddha's way? There's a sense of releasing into us, as I said before. We are not, we are freed to duality, to the functioning of the world. We are not freed from this world. We are freed to this world. This is the way, this is the meaning of this. We are freed to this reality. We are of this reality. We experience ourselves as this interconnected reality, not some tense pocket that's relating to it. This is the moment of liberation when we experience this. And then we go back, you know, because we are, after all, the way Jodo Shinshu folks say, we are foolish human beings. So, Shohaku Okumura Roshi says, I really like this line. The subject of this practice is not this person. The subject of practice is not this person. That does not mean you do not exist, and it does not mean you do not think and question, just like King Melindra. You act, you test, I exist, and I want to know, is this worthy? Is this worthy of my life's effort to follow this way? Is it? Does it work? I look around. Are people saner? What's going on here? I'm not going to be fooled. It's like Zuigon, you know? Wake up. Zuigon? Yes, Master. Are you awake? Yes, Master. Don't be fooled. So it's our responsibility to look at this and say, is this a vital way or not? Because I only got, you know, maybe we've got multiple lifetimes, but as far as I know right now, this is it. So do I want to spend my days doing this or not? Does this work or not? That's a vital thing. It's a vital part of faith.
Is that a question we should ask in a relative sense compared to other ways which we know are often inherently delusional?
Of course we have to ask it in response to other ways. Because, this is for us. This is our lifetime. It's not about better or worse or true or false. You know, we can look around. I remember I went to a conference years ago, a monastic conference, in which there was this incredible woman, and I was ready to sign up. She happened to be a Catholic nun, you know. But I was so inspired by her, I was like, honey, I'll follow you anywhere. So we have to pick what works for us. The point is, as we develop this practice, as we sit Zazen and we practice kindness to others and we practice patience and we study our lives, we begin to get a feeling for this sense. The subject of this practice is not this person. The subject of this practice is all reality, is mountain studying mountains, is Buddha studying Buddha, is this moment being this moment. So we crowbar ourselves out of being the center of the universe and let the universe be the center of the universe. Yeah? There's real freedom in that. And we have to take care in studying in this way. Because again, we don't want to fool ourselves. And we don't want to think we have to somehow evaporate ourselves. But it's this dynamic functioning of us and reality all together. This is a unique flavor of Soto Zen practice. Buddha studying Buddha's way. Zazen sitting Zazen. The subject of this practice is not this person. So understanding and practicing this requires deep questioning and also deep faith. This is a reorientation that places life at the center of our lives, and an embodied sense that one can harmoniously accord with the circumstances. Yeah. And that doing this does not threaten, it doesn't feel like a threat to who we are. Because we're not separate from what's happening. You know? We're not a separate entity. We are of it. So the self is a functioning aspect of reality. It's not obliterated with this practice. It's realized. True self is realized in this. Not obliterated. The oldest Chinese character for faith or trust is Xin. And the part of the character on the left has the meaning of person, and the part of the character on the right has the meaning of words or sayings. So the first understanding of faith is very much in line with this. Finding the word of another reliable. Something that you can trust or rely on. Ujjambara, she says that faith is also the process of clarifying the mind. It's a process. It's a verb. Faith then in this is an activity. It's the activity of practice. See, faith is an enactment. Practice is faith. It's the enactment of faith. So when we sit zazen, and we are simply letting zazen sit zazen, this is the body and breath of faith. This is the posture of faith. When we are of a circumstance, we're not fighting with it, we're taking our place within it. That is a posture of faith. That is a kind of engagement. And we are not then at war with our reality. Whatever it is, and this is challenging, when we go through something that's really difficult, to be of it is not easy, to find our way. But this is this kind of mixing it up is the posture of faith. Dogen calls this Konshin Jishin. The entire body becomes faith itself. This is the verb, faith. So jishin is confidence or trust. It's another way of talking about this personal experience. Linji, in Japanese Rinzai, great Chinese master, said, when we seek things outside ourselves, we will never be peaceful because we cannot trust ourselves. Trusting ourselves, jishin, self, ji, shin, faith or trust. This self that Lin Shi is telling us to trust is not the self that has all kinds of opinions and separation and grandiose ideas. It's not that deluded self that we're so familiar with. It's the self that takes its place in as an aspect of reality. It is the self of faith. That self knows itself to be a part of everything and does not need to chase around finding everybody to say, it's okay, it's okay, it's okay. But we do that, don't we? We need affirmation. We have to have a humble and compassionate heart that welcomes everything, including our delusions, including our vulnerabilities. It's all included. So this isn't meant as a way to berate ourselves and not seek support or encouragement. That's another way of reinforcing isolation. Lin Shi is pointing to a way of greater ease and peace. When we know, even for a moment, the true nature of the self, its inherent trustworthiness emerges. When we can let go of our self-centered notions, even for a moment, and be of this earth, of this world, of this moment, a certain kind of faith and trustworthiness emerges. So this confidence blooms. This is Jishin, confidence. So this is a realization, making real, feeling, experiencing the self that knows itself to be a part of all reality, the self that is Buddha. So usually faith comes first as an affinity or a belief in the teachings, a teacher or practice. We look around, we say, that looks good. And this is a kind of provisional faith or a kind of affinity. It's like we're being drawn towards something. And then we test it out. We see, does this work? And this is very important. So this would be akin to the first meaning of the word shin, which is the belief, faith in another. Somebody else is trustworthy. Something's trustworthy out there. And so I can have a respectful engagement with it. And we like King Melindra, we ask questions and say, not just ask questions, we say, show me. Right? Give me an example. And we don't. We look around, pay attention. This, we test the waters in a realistic and healthy way. We have a working hypothesis that we find as sound. This practice does indeed clarify the muddy waters of our lives. Then gradually, we see the usefulness of the teachings. And like Thich Nhat Hanh has said, we develop confidence, we receive confidence, that when we put the teachings into practice, we overcome difficulty. Our life becomes easier. We see our self-centered ideas for what they are, and we start to experience ourselves differently. As we do this, we trust in the Buddha way. You know, we have verified faith. We trust in the Buddha way, and we trust ourselves in a certain way, and we can, with that trust, we can let go. We can really let the teachings penetrate. We can let go into this moment. We can let the self change. The self is this fundamental touchstone of the way we experience our lives. We can actually allow that to change. And when we do that, ideas of what we're going to gain by doing practice begin to change and fade. You know, so we may start out with a certain idea, and then as we practice, it starts to change. Well, oh, I thought this was going to happen. No, that's not happening. Something else is happening. Dogen says, just to wholeheartedly accept and trust that to study the way with the mind is the mountain, rivers, and earth mind itself thoroughly engaged in studying the way. Okay, this is mountains. We are mountain studying mountain. We are the way studying the way. We are Zazen studying Zazen. So this is an experience of trust. It requires that we develop a trust that relinquishing our ordinary ideas is not suicidal. It's not harmful. We have to actually experience that it's not harmful to us to change. So saying, the mind of human beings is very hard to change. Very hard to change. But as we do this, as we take this posture in our lives, we build this spirit of Soto Zen practice, the spirit of practice, we taste it, becomes real for us, becomes alive for us. So we look at the roots of how we order our lives, right? What do we believe in? What are our deepest values? How does the Dharma take a place in there or not? You know, it's not necessary. This is what I believe makes the most sense to me. But whatever makes sense to you, be aware of it, so that your life becomes transformed actually, in concretely, according to those values. So this is like a pilgrimage. You know, our life is like a pilgrimage, right? Shinshu and I went and saw this movie called The Camino. Has anybody seen it?
Mm-hmm.
How many have seen it? If you haven't seen it, it's down at the Nick. I think it might still be there. It's a movie that was made about the Camino de Santiago, which is a pilgrimage route in Spain that's been there for, I don't know, a couple thousand years, maybe. And the movie is about these people. There's like five or six people, maybe more. And they start on this pilgrimage, and it's a documentary. It's about real people. And they start on this pilgrimage, and they have all these ideas about what this is going to be like. And one young guy is really fit, and he's just like, I had a choice between doing this or going to the beach, so I'm going to go do this. Another woman is very sincere, Catholic woman, young woman, like pushing her pram, right, with a baby in it.
It's 500 miles.
It's 500 miles. Yeah, 500 miles. And they walk and they stay in these specific places. We got it?
Yeah, got it.
They walk and they stay in these places together in which people are snoring, and, you know, it's like this, it's this ongoing community thing. And this woman fights with her brother, and, you know, there's just all this life, right? So they set out on this pilgrimage with an idea of what's going to happen. And then their ideas change. It's hard. They get this one guy who's so buff gets blisters. He's limping. He's having a hard time. His buddies give him his shoes. He meets these people. There's, you know, all of this stuff happens. This one woman feels like there's no way she's in pain. There's no way she's going to do this. And she discovers she has to go much, much slower than she thought. But there's this sense that as they go, the ordering principles of their life changes. And they can't anticipate this. This is the activity of faith, right? They keep going because they set out to do this thing, and they have these ideas, but they're willing to let go of their ideas and actually experience what's happening and be changed by it. So the activity is just the walking. They're just walking every day. They lose I'm going to get this far. To have these people that are like, well, we're really competitive and we wanted to go really fast, and then they just lose it, right? So it's what's so fascinating to me is that to me this is the activity of faith. Walking every day, getting up and walking every day is the activity of faith. And it changes us. So we may have faith. They may have faith in this pilgrimage because they thought they would get something specific out of it, right? And maybe they did. But then they, and that's one form of faith. Maybe they had friends who did this and said it was great and changed their lives. So they say, okay, that looks wholesome. You know, it's a wholesome thing to do. It's a reliable thing to do. I'm going to do that. It looks good. People have been doing it for a couple thousand years. Looks good. I'll try that. I'll do that. I'll take that walk. But then they get on the walk, and the activity of doing the walk changes who they are. And there's no way they could have anticipated this. This is Buddha studying Buddha's way. This is Zazen sitting Zazen. This is walking doing walking. And there's no anticipating what's going to happen. In fact, the feeling you get at the end of the movie is that the impact of this pilgrimage is going to go on for the rest of their lives. It's not ending with the pilgrimage, because there's something that's come alive in their lives that's going to transform what they're doing. So when we, in Soto Zen, when we do a practice, we can certainly have the idea that it's going to have a certain kind of outcome. For example, if you know you're going into a difficult situation at work, and you stop and take a breath, and remember that you really want to align with values of non-harming, that will probably have an impact. Maybe not, but it's possible, right? If you sit in the morning and you sit consistently, chances are really good you'll be a little calmer in your life. And there's nothing wrong with saying, I want to be calmer, so I'm going to sit. I want to have healthier food, so I'm going to cook at home and have something. There's nothing wrong with wanting to have concrete goals, right? But the spirit of Soto Zen incorporates that, but also says there's a dynamic life happening here that's beyond what you can imagine. You are not just that person. You are Buddha studying Buddha's way. And what? How to have faith in that? What does that mean? That means practice is the activity of faith. And I'm going to give myself over to that moment intelligently in such a way that I actually can taste. We say taste the truth of the Tathagata's words. It's a physical event. It's not just an intellectual event. It's a physical, embodied faith event. That's the breath and posture of faith in our lives. That's Buddha enacting Buddha's way. So, I encourage you to test, to question, to find what's most meaningful, and to have deep confidence that you are of the way already. Then you can, you know, be like these people on this pilgrimage and actually intend to do something for a certain result, and at the same time allow yourself to be changed from the inside out by the activity of the Buddha's way, by the activity of faith. Okay, let's stop there. And I was going to talk a little bit about fear, but maybe I'll do that next week. And questions, comments? Yes.
So, along the same lines of where you were just at, so this next moment is coming, you know, whether I like it or not, it's mm-hmm. coming.
Yeah.
So I can have trust and faith and be totally calm about it. I have a plan, but whatever happens, I'll be calm about it. Is there benefit to having a optimistic attitude towards what's coming as opposed to a calm? Certainly I don't want a pessimistic, fearful attitude towards what's coming. But is it preferable just to be completely neutral and let it happen, or be enthusiastic and optimistic about how I'm going to respond?
You're going to be however you are. You might be scared to death. That's also Buddha studying Buddha's way. You might be nervous. You might be cranky. You might be. You might not be calm at all. You know, if you're calm, great. If you're not calm, that's also included. So it's important for us to have a very wide view that we really are including everything. We're not truncating down. Now, having said that, it's a lot pleasanter for us and everybody else if we cultivate calmness, right? It's really much nicer. But if you're not, you're not. How do you manage that? How is that Buddha studying Buddha's way? How, when you find out something terrible and you're wailing with grief or rage or you're bored stiff in a meeting that you have to go to, or how is all of that included? Because that is that moment. You know, that's the moment. And so this is a little mind-boggling, because it's really like this moment. This is it. That's included. So it's a negotiation in a way. It's having a clear eye to what's helpful and wholesome and supportive for us to cultivate, and also being radically present for whatever is happening. Both.
So maybe I understood, but not that, maybe what he was saying is that if you're going to set an intention, though, sometimes you set intentions and something comes in the way, and that's okay. But if you're going to set an intention, instead of just staying neutral, if you set an intention that's positive and optimistic,
but
that's a good thing.
Well, we have to see this is where we align with our values. So, for example, setting an intention, it's like sometimes awareness practices can be, and I'm not saying you were saying this, but sometimes awareness practices can be understood to be like watching a movie, like somehow we're supposed to be, or, you know, like it's somehow not our lives, we're not of it, we're just supposed to watch it and be neutral. And if that's what you're talking about, that's not what we mean. When we set an intention, this is why the Bodhisattva's way is so important. We want to live and be lived for the benefit of all beings. There's a positive intention. We want to be calmer so that we generate calmness in an environment. We want to be kind so that we plant seeds of kindness. We want to keep an open mind and view people looking for the best. So, yes, we do set an intention, and we do want to cultivate these positive qualities.
That suggests an active engagement.
Yes, absolutely.
More than a passive one.
Absolutely. We're not talking passive here. That's also an engagement. That's also a posture, right? Passiveness is a choice. If we see something happening that's bad in the world and we don't do something, that's a choice. That's an action. There's no getting around taking an action, even if it's a non-action. But what kind of action are we going to take, and what's behind it? And how can we both have humility and acceptance of our own deluded nature, right, that we habitually do, and at the same time have tenderness for ourselves and others, and aspire towards, it's like the faith thing, aspire towards who we want to be in the world and what we want to create in the world.
Acceptance does not preclude participation.
No, good. I'm so glad you said that. It's really important. Acceptance is not passivity. Just like the teachings of no self do not mean there's no self. There is very definitely a self, and we are going to make choices. And we are a part. It's not like there's all of reality and then a whole where we exist. We're there, and we're participating, whether we like it or not. So how are we going to do that? How? This is called our family name, what? How? Our family name is how.
Oh.
Not why. Not thinking about, but how, because it's happening already. Our life is living itself already. How are we going to do that? Passivity is a cop-out, because it's just another action, which is an idea that we have. You know, if you walk into a room and everybody's like this, how does that feel? Yeah, achy. You know, that has a feeling, that has a choice to it. So, passivity or neutrality. There is a kind of neutrality that's very warm and spacious. That's like, I'm curious. I want to be open to this. That's a certain kind of neutrality, but it's not dead neutrality. It's not a manhole cover over us. It's a kind of spaciousness or openness that's willing to be with life as it is.
And letting things unfold.
Yes.
On their own.
And participating. You know, we see the suffering of the world. We're not neutral to that. We're not saying, oh, you know, we're in a drought. Let's just let the drought unfold. And in the meantime, I'm washing my dishes and the water's going down the sink. Well, okay, it's just unfolding. No, we turn the tap off. There's simple actions like that that have to do with aligning ourselves with ending suffering as much as we can. Then we are changed by that. It's not just the external reality. We're participating in a certain way. Yeah. Are there questions, comments? Really?
Wow. Here's one.
Thank you.
No. One of the things the greatest learnings, I think, for me, studying with you and Shinshu, has been watching you when what you very much want to happen is right out there, and you still maintain allegiance to the precepts. You don't do what you could probably, you're both very intelligent, capable people. You know, you can move things around to get what you want, and you don't ever do that. And to me, the equanimity, the openness, I can do that really well when I'm not especially attached.
Isn't that the truth?
But it's when I really want something and I know that I know how to get it.
Uh-huh.
To set that aside.
Uh-huh.
I haven't been able to do that yet.
It's really tough, isn't it? It's not easy. This is when we talk about the precepts, we talk about these guiding principles, not killing, not stealing, you know, not taking what is not given. But the thing that is so, this is where the testing comes in. Because if we take this on, if we say, okay, I really want my life, you know, then if we have one of these on, it means that we've decided to publicly say, I'm going to live by these principles, by the principles of Buddhist practice. Publicly. I'm accountable here. So when you sew one of these by hand, and each stitch you take refuge in the Buddha. You say, I'm aligning myself, I'm aligning myself with the teachings. That's what I want to guide my life. And you test those out, because the precepts are not something that's coming down from above that tells you, you should do this, you should do that, and if you don't, you're going to be bad. They grew up out of human community, and there are teachings that say, this works. You know what? If you follow these precepts, not only will you be happier, but so will everybody else. But it can sound austere or harsh from the outside, so we have to test them out. And we have to taste the fact that actually aligning ourselves with the precepts gives us greater peace. The precepts are a description of the Bodhisattva's mind. They're a description of how to live life in such a way that we are happier. So even if it looks like, you know, like the last piece of chocolate cake is there, and we really like chocolate cake, mm-hmm. and we know that it's going to taste good, if we don't know the feeling that allowing someone else to have that last piece of chocolate cake tastes even better than having the chocolate cake, we're going to be at war with ourselves. But when we actually taste in our bodies that letting somebody else have that piece of chocolate cake or not being attached to whether we get it or not actually feels good, it makes us happier, then it just becomes like what you do. But you can't tell yourself to do that. It has to be something that you actually live with an experience. And that's the same way with this faith, right? That is an act of faith, but it's also verified. It's like, yeah, I know, that works. It's not just something I made up. That's why I say, you know, look in your lives and see what are the basic principles that really guide you, and how are you living them out. You know, it could be the commandments. It could be I don't know. But if it's the Buddhist teachings, then you say, this is a model that works for me, and this is how I'm going to enact it. This is about faith. Yeah.
The image that you brought up about the clarifying the water and the, and all the impurities and mud going at the bottom, what came to mind for me is how that mud stays there until there's difficulties in our life, and how rich that mud is when the difficulties
that's
churn
a good way
the mud
of putting
up,
it.
And we get to really look at what it is that and how we want to respond to this difficulty.
Yeah.
And then when we do, then once again the mud settles down, but it's always there waiting.
Right. And the thing that we know is that, I was just reading some things about, I can't remember which Rinzai teacher was. Sorry, I can't remember, but he was talking about the difference between a life lived in a very constructed way that supports formal practice and the life that we live in ordinary life. And he was praising ordinary life because it gives us so many opportunities to stir up the mud. And when we do that, our mountain-likeness, our strength grows. Our faith grows. We grow as human beings because we learn something more. We get a little bit stronger. It's like lacquerware, you know. Layer after layer, it looks really, really thin. But in the end, it's this very flexible but hard and beautiful thing. So each time we manage to have a little more patience, a little more kindness, a little more awakeness, a little more joining with others, we change. Yeah.
The teachings are the practices all around. One is, you know, we drive.
Yeah.
And that's been a big one.
Oh, it's a big one.
And it's all the time because people are so aggressive.
Yeah.
And I remembered what you said the other day, because usually when I see somebody aggressive on my tail, because I'm a pretty mellow driver, I think, you know, to myself, gosh, you're going to get to the stoplight at the same time I do anyway. Are you really in that much of a hurry? You know, it's kind of negative, but it's still, I'm not like screaming at them or anything like that, but it's more kind of like, really?
Yeah.
And then I thought about what you said about, well, maybe I'm in their way.
Yeah. Yeah, so we have, and then we can think to ourselves, is it really true that I've never been kind of anxious and pushy? Never in my life have I never been? So we can say, oh, I understand that. I understand that. I understand what that feels like, and I can have compassion for myself and all beings who are feeling anxious and pushy in that moment. And that is an alignment, right? So that's a moment of practice.
Right, and if you're in a cave practicing,
then you deal with your own mind, right?
Then you're in your own way.
Yeah. Other questions or comments about this discussion of faith or anything else? That
I had an experience recently sitting zazen here on a Thursday morning. A car passed by and must have had a window down, and there was music playing. And it wasn't blaring or anything. It was just, you know, someone was just driving early in the morning with their window down with the stereo on. Yeah, maybe trying to have some coffee and listen to some music. And in that moment, in the time it took for that car to just pass by, I experienced a connection with that person. I have no idea, of course, who they were, anything about them. But they were unaware that someone was listening to that music with them. Someone was experiencing them driving down the road.
Yeah.
And they probably thought they were alone, or they probably thought, I'm just with this other person that I'm with. And yet, this, there was an, this might not be the right word, but there was an intimacy to the connection that I felt, that someone was being experienced, unbeknownst to them.
Mm-hmm.
And it sort of, it triggered questions for me. I've been thinking about this a little bit and thinking, what does this mean? Why is it sort of sticking with me?
Uh-huh.
And, it does occur to me that it has something to do with interconnectedness, and it also has to do with the idea that there is no separation between us.
Yes,
we're all sort of the same animal. The only thing that makes us separate is the idea that we're separate.
Yes.
I know we always have the caveat of there is an individual, preferences and all that. But it was an actual experience of sort of living someone else being lived.
Uh-huh. That's it. There you go. That's the truth of what our reality is all the time. Have you ever noticed that we think we can fool other people? We think other people don't see who we are. It's not true. I mean, I really got this when we lived at our monastery. It's like, there's no way you can spend any time there without people seeing you completely. But it's true all the time. People see us all the time, but we somehow have this idea that we're fooling them, or that we're separate from them, or that somehow we are playing our music and no one else hears it. But that's not the truth of it. We are completely intimate, completely embedded. And when we have moments where we actually realize that, that's inspiring to us. It changes us. Yeah. Even when we can't remember it, it changes us. Yeah. Yes.
I'm not entirely sure about it. I'll try anyway. I appreciate that you went back around between and talked a little bit about kind of faith and belief, because I think there's faith in the activity of the teachings and the practice, and I think that we have to hold the beliefs a little lighter and even have faith for those to be destroyed in the process.
Yes.
There's a quote, and I can't remember, but it was a teacher saying, "Why are you in such a hurry to get enlightened? You might not like it."
Yeah, that's Suzuki Roshi.
But the idea that You might be wrong. You have to have enough faith in your practice, in your activity, that it might not be what you think it is. I have some really devout Christian friends that are worried about me because I'm not.
Yeah.
When I always tell them, I said, look, if I'm sitting Zazen some morning and Jesus pops up and goes, boom, great. I don't expect it, but I'm not willing to, say that.
That's good. That's good.
And I think faith in the activity of practice does that.
Yes. Yes, this is great, because belief, we all have beliefs, and we should have beliefs. We should examine them and see if they're worthy of our lives, and we should live according to them, right? And we should be willing to have them change, and certainly not go to war over them. Because they're beliefs. So that's good. All these people that went on this pilgrimage, they had all kinds of different beliefs and held more or less strongly, and they were all changed. So it's a very good point. And if you're sitting sometime and Jesus pops up, let me know, will you?
I describe Buddhism as a method of inquiry. Our practice is a method of inquiry, and we have our hypotheses, and then we inquire.
Yes, you inquire. And so the two aspects of faith that I've been talking about today is, on the one hand, I test it out. And on the other hand, I become familiar with the experience of Buddha practicing Buddha's way. So it's like, how is that? Yeah? Both of those things are essential. Good. No. Be careful if you bring your hands up. I might think you have a question. It's like an auction.
Thank goodness,
right?
This isn't an auction.
Yeah. Sold. Yeah.
A friend of mine went on that pilgrimage.
Uh-huh.
And she's 63. It was really a big thing for her. And she told me that at the end of... And she was writing to me from being on the pilgrimage, mm-hmm. sending these emails on her telephone. And she said at the very end, there's a church, and where she had planned that she was mm-hmm. going to attend services, and she was getting a very early start, so she wanted to be able to be right in the front so she could experience that completion and being up there. And indeed, she did get there very early and was in the front seat, front pew. And she looked around at the people, and she noticed there was a man standing at the entrance. He had no shoes. He was just totally poverty-stricken and very, very thin, and his clothes were ragged. And she gave him her seat.
Uh-huh.
And she said that she had never thought that she would, that would happen. But that and she stood in the doorway.
Uh-huh.
And that was the perfect ending for her.
Uh-huh. That's great. And she could never have predicted that.
Never.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's it. It's a bodhisattva way.
Yeah.
Yeah. What we would call a bodhisattva way, what she might call an act of Christ.
Right.
There you go.